laws of nature create vastly different worlds with the tiniest of changes. You're listening to Western Worlds. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University, located in the home of David Suzuki, London, Ontario, Canada. I'd like to welcome you to the Season 1 finale of Western Worlds. With us tonight to finish off these first 14 episodes is none other than Dr. Jamie Matthews from the University of British Columbia. Dr. Matthews is the principal investigator of the MOST Space Telescope, the first space-based platform designed to look at the small-scale oscillations of stars. Before there was Kepler, before even Corot, there was MOST, whose 15-centimeter aperture earned it the nickname the Humble Space Telescope. But this is one case where outward appearances can be deceiving. You don't need to gather a lot of light to observe the bright stars, but you do need sophisticated electronics to detect changes in brightness as small as one part in a million. Those small changes can give insights into stellar structure and can also be used to observe extrasolar planets via the transit method. Ultimately, what MOST represents is a Canadian space success story across the entire space sector, built and flown for a fraction of the cost of other space telescopes using technology made in Canada for a Canadian science team. Nearly a decade after its launch, the spacecraft continues to take valuable observations. As well, many of the students trained by the science team have gone on to positions on American and European extrasolar groups, spreading our expertise far and wide. While Canada spends less on its space agency than NASA or ESA in both absolute and per capita terms, we do specialize in designing innovative, low-cost microsatellites, as Dr. Matthews professes. Such satellites can be extremely successful if their objectives are sufficiently focused, as was the case with MOST. These days, Dr. Matthews is considering the bigger picture. As you have heard over the past 14 episodes, there is now an unprecedented wealth of knowledge on extrasolar planets, with new information continuing to pour in every day. What can these other solar systems teach us about our own world? It's an intriguing question, with a surprising answer to which Brian Cox's opening quote alludes. While we're going away for a bit, I'm looking forward to more conversations here at Western Worlds in just a few months' time, so fear not. Just like MOST, I hope that our first season is but a harbinger of what is to come. As such, I have selected Harbinger from the compilation Music of the Spheres and composed by Mike Oldfield as our music tonight. Without further ado, let's transition to my interview with Jamie Matthews. Professor Matthews, thank you for taking the time to speak with us today. I understand you are rather involved with the MOST telescope. Can you tell us a little bit about that satellite?
MOST stands for Microvariability and Oscillations of Stars. Microvariabilité, Oscillation Stellaire, perfect Canadian acronym, which is what it studies, is very subtle variations in the brightnesses of stars and the planets orbiting around other stars. Because of its small size and small budget and its Canadian identity, we nicknamed it the Humble Space Telescope. But although MOST is essentially a suitcase in space, 54 kilos in mass, dimensions of 60 by 60 by 30 centimeters, I weigh more than MOST does when it was on the Earth. It's incredibly powerful and does things that even the Hubble Space Telescope is not capable of doing. And that is measuring changes in the brightnesses of stars down to a level of one part in a million. Even astronomers have still a hard time wrapping our heads around brightness changes, changes in flux that small. And if astronomers have this problem, you can imagine that federal government bureaucrats that one is approaching for funding have that problem too. So I had to come up with a way to explain the design capability of MOST in a way that a non-rocket scientist could understand. And this is what I came up with. If you could imagine going to New York City and looking at the Empire State Building at night, all of the lights are on, all of the office window shades are completely open. You can make the Empire State Building fainter, less luminous, by one part in a million, by 1/10,000 of a percent, by having one person stand at one window and pull down one window shade by 3 centimeters. And if you had them move that shade up and down by 3 centimeters, you would make the Empire State Building oscillate in brightness by one part in a million. And that's the capability that MOST was designed to achieve, and which it did achieve. And we were the pioneers in this. MOST was launched aboard a former Soviet nuclear missile, honest-to-goodness delivery system for a weapon of mass destruction, on June 30th, the day before Canada Day, in 2003. And we were followed into space 3.5 years later by a French mission, Corot. And then almost 7 years after that, the Americans joined us with the Kepler mission, which is NASA's exo-Earth hunter in space.
So what makes it really unique then is the one part in 10 to the sixth and being sort of the first on the scene there.
That's right. We're accustomed to thinking of opening new windows, new technology, new capability in science and particularly in astronomy. For example, putting up a satellite to be able to see stars and galaxies in the ultraviolet or in the far infrared or at gamma ray wavelengths. And so those are territories of the electromagnetic spectrum that have been opened up. In the case of MOST, the territory that was opened up in parameter space, one was this photometric precision, but also time coverage. Because if you were on the Earth, on most locations on the Earth, at an observatory and you're observing the stars, there's this annoying thing called the sun that keeps coming up and preventing you from observing the stars, at least at optical wavelengths. And I'll admit that the sun does have some redeeming features, but for an observational astronomer who's not studying the sun, it can be a real nuisance. And so what's happening is from a given observatory on the Earth, your observations of, say, a star will last for a few hours in the night, and then they have to stop. And then the next night, they start again, and then they have to stop. And then the next night, maybe they start again, maybe it's cloudy, and then they stop. And eventually, you're kicked off the telescope because there are other astronomers who want to use it. And so astronomers had never had the luxury of putting astronomical bodies under the astronomical equivalent of a police stakeout, where you could monitor them 24 hours a day for weeks, months at a time. And that's a capability that MOST offered for the first time. And imagine if you are, say, a detective and you're monitoring a suspect, you've got them under surveillance. Imagine if you could only actually know what they were doing for a few hours at night when likely they're sleeping and not doing anything particularly interesting. That was the situation that astronomers had to deal with for almost the entire history of astronomy. And so MOST finally gave us this way to look continuously for up to 2 months at a time with this level of light measuring precision that had never been possible before. And so it was no surprise that you just see phenomena, you understand stars, and understand the nature of planets around other stars in ways that just was never possible before.
It's that polar orbit that gives it the ability to look for so long, isn't it?
In the orbit, we had to make a compromise in the sense of if we put the satellite further away from the Earth, which would be great in terms of allowing us to see a much larger patch of the sky without interruption, the problem is that you are in a more hostile radiation environment at a higher altitude, and you're further away from the Earth, and so you need more powerful radios and bigger receiving dishes to be able to get the data down. And so we made a compromise. We put it into a polar sun-synchronous orbit, orbiting above the terminator, the dividing line between day and night on the Earth. And at that altitude, you can kind of imagine a cone radiating outward from the telescope on board the satellite. And that cone rolls on the upper atmosphere of the Earth And as most orbits around the Earth, pole over pole, any star that's in that cone sticking out from the side is never occulted by the Earth during the orbit. And so you have continuous coverage. And as the Earth moves in its orbit around the Sun, and carrying most along with it, then stars slide through this cone, which we call the continuous viewing zone, CVZ, which is about 54 degrees wide. And so a star going right through the center of that cone would be visible without interruption for 2 months. And so, yes, that orbit was very carefully chosen. And it's not a perfect polar orbit. It's actually tilted slightly because we want to be sun synchronous. And the tilt and the altitude of the orbit are chosen so that the plane of the orbit precesses, and so we always stay over that dividing line of day and night.
Now, it is, as you mentioned, it's a very small satellite, mm-hmm. and the aperture is fairly small as well, about 6 inches?
Yeah, 15 centimeters.
Mm-hmm. So,
size of a pie plate.
Indeed. So was it difficult to actually round up support for a telescope of that size in space?
Well, it's interesting. If I go back, the science that I wanted to do is astroseismology, stellar seismology, using the surface vibrations of stars measured through changes in their light, whether it's the brightness or the Doppler shifts of the light emitted from the surface, to probe their internal structure, because the insides of stars are completely hidden from view. The sun, the light that we see from the sun escapes from a layer maybe 200 kilometers deep, but the sun itself is 700,000 kilometers in radius, and everything below that layer of 200, 300 kilometers is completely hidden from view except for neutrinos, which escape from the core of the sun due to the thermonuclear reactions that make the sun shine. So probing inside a star is not an easy thing. Probing inside the Earth is not an easy thing either, normally. The deepest mine cores, drill cores, are maybe 10 kilometers deep into the crust. Center of the Earth, 6,400 kilometers beneath our feet, might as well be 6,400 million billion light years for all our ability to go there. But we know what it's like there because of vibrations due to earthquakes, which propagate through the interior of the Earth and they emerge at the surface, and they tell us the conditions through which they travel. And we can do that for stars, except that for many stars, like the Sun, their vibrations are so subtle that essentially in brightness, they're completely washed out by the turbulence in the Earth's atmosphere, the thing that makes stars twinkle and dance in the sky in our vision. And so I knew that we needed to be above the atmosphere in space, but space is expensive. And I felt that the best way for Canada to have a foot in the door for these kind of data would be to be a small partner with a big European mission called Eddington. And that's what I was trying to pitch to the Canadian Space Agency, that we contribute some subsystem at the level of a few million dollars, and that we would have access to those data. And then there was a unique synergy. Basically, the kind of science that I wanted to do and technology that was developed by a small company called Dynacon at the time. It's now known as MSCI, Microsat Systems Canada Incorporated, a spin-off from the UTIAS Space Flight Lab, University of Toronto Institute for Aerospace Studies Space Flight Lab. And they had come up with a way to stabilize a microsatellite, something with a mass less than 100 kilos, something with dimensions smaller than a meter, to point more accurately than had been possible before. And because such something that has very little inertia, so it's easy to be tugged and to drift away from an accurate pointing. And the normal kind of reaction wheel technology that's used on, say, the Hubble Space Telescope, it relies on the inertia. You know, the Hubble has the mass and size of a minivan, of a bus, and so the reaction wheels have enough time to respond to keep it pointing very accurately. But now, if you have something the size and mass of a suitcase, you need to have a really rapid response time, but you can't have a lot of mass associated with that system. You can't consume a lot of power associated with that system. They came up with a way that, in principle, they could do it. And they needed a demonstrator. And it was just this perfect match, because I didn't need a big telescope. I didn't need a big light bucket, because we could do this on relatively bright stars. I just needed a small telescope with the right kind of detector, the right kind of instrumentation in the right orbit, and that could point. And The going rate to lift something from the surface to low Earth orbit is about $20,000 US per kilo. And so the fewer kilos that you have to put up, the better. And so a conventional mission with these kinds of science goals, like the European mission, like what eventually became Corot and Kepler, these things have masses of hundreds of kilos, metric tons. And so the launch costs are very large. Putting up 54 kilos and being able to negotiate with the Russians to cut that lift cost down to half, to 10,000 per kilo, basically you could put most up for about $500,000. And our entire budget of $10 million would be less than most comparable missions' launch budgets. It was that mix. Suddenly, out of nowhere, I realized that we had the possibility of doing this first, but we were a dark horse because nobody ever thought of putting a telescope or a camera, whether it was looking up outward into space or back down towards the Earth, on a microsat, because nobody had been able to stabilize a microsat attitude control with pointing better than about 1 or 2 degrees. The diameter of the full moon at night or the sun in your vision is half a degree. So no one had ever thought about doing it. And we were in a competition for a Canadian Space Agency microsat science program out of, I believe, 54 proposals. We were the only astronomical proposal. Everything else was sort of Earth's magnetosphere or engineering in space. But we made it into the Phase A competition, and we won the Phase A competition, and then went forward, and suddenly we were the first into space. We were the pioneers. And I think there was still even skepticism, because for space missions, there's a certain formula, a certain template. You've got a big aerospace company. The ivory tower scientists like me are principal investigator, but have a more limited role. But in this case, having a university-led project with a prime contractor that was this tiny little upstart company that had offshot from a university lab just wasn't the way these things were done. Using untested technology on a microsat to do literally frontier astrophysics. And so I think it's fair to say a lot of people expected us to fall flat on our face. They just, for some reason, they wouldn't work, either just because we couldn't manage the project right, or because the technology wouldn't work, or whatever. And it all came together. I mean, we were supposed to be a one-year mission to observe 10 stars. That would have satisfied what we promised in terms of getting the funding. We're approaching our 9th birthday in space with more than 3,000 stars under our belt. We're doing science that was never part of the original mission, including exoplanetary science. Most was proposed, designed, funded, and we were cutting metal before I realized that even I had underestimated what you could do with a 15-centimeter aperture telescope with the right instrument in the right orbit, and said, you know, we can do stuff on exoplanets that nobody else can do. And we've gone even beyond that. People ask me, you know, what about MOST-2? And I must admit, when I came up with the acronym MOST, I never thought about what I'd call another one, MOSTER, MOSTEST. My personal preferences are foremost and utmost. But the real answer is that MOST-1 has become MOST-2 and MOST-3. We can't change the hardware that's up there 820 kilometers overhead, but we've totally revamped the software. We know how to operate that hardware much better. We've changed the pipelines of how we process the data on the ground. The things we're doing now, we're getting better photometry than we've ever gotten in the entire mission. We're doing science that was never, ever on the table before. And so literally, MOST-1 has become MOST-2 and even MOST-3. It's almost like a third-generation satellite in its more than 8.5 years in space.
That's impressive how everything just sort of comes together sometimes. Now, you mentioned the exoplanets, and it makes perfect sense if you're looking at these slight variations in brightness that you could perhaps see things like transits and whatnot. What has MOST seen in terms of exoplanetary searches?
Yeah. The most obvious thing that one would do with photometry, with a light curve, a record of the brightness of a star or time, if you're looking for exoplanets, is if the orbit of that planet carries it in front of the star and you see a transit, which results in a small dip in the starlight. And that can be, and was originally detected in some systems from the ground, but the smaller the planet, the smaller the dip. And at some point you need to go into space in order to see those. But one of the things that MOST did for the first time before anybody else was not look for the dip in the starlight when the planet passes in front of the star, but look for the dip in the total light you're getting when the planet passes behind the star, because the planet planet is reflecting, scattering some of that starlight back to you. And when it disappears behind the star, you lose a little bit of light. To give you a sense of how much light you lose, imagine trying to detect a mosquito buzzing behind a standard city 400-watt city street lamp, except that that street lamp is 1,000 kilometers away. And that's actually easier than what we do to measure the eclipse of a planet. And my former graduate student, Jason Rowe, who is now a key member of the NASA Kepler team, his thesis was to measure the eclipse of a planet for the first time. And what we found, what was a real surprise, was how non-reflective, how dark in some sense the planet was. Jupiter, in our own solar system, has an albedo, a reflectivity of about 50%. The planet we were studying, HD 209458b, we're not very good at naming planets, has a reflectivity of less than about 12%. It's about as reflective as charcoal, which is like one of the darkest known natural substances. And that told us a lot about the atmosphere of this planet. And when we combine that with infrared data obtained from the NASA Spitzer Infrared Observatory and from other instruments, we've been able to actually put together a picture of what the atmosphere is, its composition, its temperature structure. It's amazing. I can tell you something about the weather on a planet that you can't even see around a star 60 light years away, and I can't even tell you what the weather is going to be like here tomorrow. That still impresses me. And so the MOST had opened up that field. Another field that it opened up, which was a real surprise to all of us, is what's now known as star exoplanet coupling. We're accustomed to the idea that a star influences the planets around it, the sun influences us on the Earth. But no one had ever really thought of a planet influencing its parent star. And we found in a system called Talbotus that the planet was in some sense leading the star around by the nose. I called it the tail-wagging dog system, in which the magnetosphere of this planet is entangled with the magnetic field lines emanating from the star. And what it's doing is creating stellar activity, spots and flares, storms, if you will, in the atmosphere of the star beneath the planet. So as the planet orbits around, it basically, this sort of storm front moves with it. And it's teaching us things about how a stellar magnetic field interacts with a planetary magnetic field. And hey, here on the Earth, the interactions of the sun's wind and magnetic field with the Earth's magnetosphere are really important issues. And we found other systems like that. And now there's this whole new field of star exoplanet coupling. Now, we predicted, we said, this is the only explanation for what we're seeing. We had ruled out every other thing. And so colleagues, mine including a former graduate student, Evgenia Shkolnik, used an instrument to do spectropolarimetry, to measure the magnetic field, not only measure the magnetic field, but map the magnetic field of the star with an instrument called Espedons. And not only did they, inspired by the MOST results, make the very first measurement of the magnetic field of a planet-hosting star other than the sun, but they mapped that magnetic field and found exactly as we predicted that all of the magnetic field energy was concentrated directly beneath the planet at what we call the subplanetary point. And that, in fact, the planet had succeeded in locking the outer envelope of the star. So the whole star was actually rotating in sync, at least the outer part of the star rotating in sync with the planet. This is just stuff that even science fiction writers wouldn't have actually thought of this happening. So that's another area in exoplanet science, a door that was opened by MOST and its capabilities.
These are really exotic environments. I mean, we're talking about giant planets with essentially rock clouds in their atmosphere and giant planets locked onto the stellar atmosphere. It's almost like a titanic struggle between the two of them. Mm-hmm. What kinds of lessons, though, does the search for exoplanets and what we've discovered about exoplanets, what does that tell us about our own Earth and our own solar system?
I was invited to be the new Jacob Bronowski Memorial Lecturer. This lecture series was started at New College at the University of Toronto when I was a first-year student. And the first lecturer was Carl Sagan. So I had to meet Carl Sagan when I was in first year. And that series continued until the 1990s, and then it stopped. And in honor of the 50th anniversary of New College, they decided to revive the lecture series 20 years later, and I was invited to be the first new Bronowski lecturer. And the title of my talk was The Rocket Science of Sustainability, What Other Worlds Can Teach Us About Our Own. And it makes people scratch their heads. What can an astrophysicist teach me about sustainability, about climate change, about the environment. And my message is that really the reason that we study other planets, the reason at least I study other planets, and I think why everyone should be doing it if they're doing it, is because it teaches us more about our own planet. It puts the Earth in a context that we just could not recognize if we were just looking at the Earth or even the planets in our solar system in isolation. What we're finding is, planet, if you were an experimental chemist or physicist, and you're trying to understand either a phenomenon like some law of nature or a substance, what you do is you try to expose it to a wide variety of conditions. You know, say you're trying to understand how something responds to changes in temperature. Well, you're not just going to leave it in the room and turn up the thermostat by a few degrees and turn it down. What you're going to do is you're going to put it in the thermal vacuum chamber and crank the temperature up to 100,000 Kelvin and see what happens, and then cryogenically cool it down to a few tens of Kelvin above zero and see what happens to it. Testing under that range of conditions gives you the leverage in terms of understanding how it responds, and it will allow you to come up with a relationship, if there is one that exists, that now you can fine-tune to understand, okay, how will it respond if the room warms up by a few degrees? Same thing with climate of the Earth. We have climate change models, but we can't turn up the thermostat, or at least we don't want to intentionally turn up the thermostat and change the climate, the environment, to a breaking point. But we can find other planets which are in orbits or around certain types of stars which represent other extremes in terms of environment and climate. Perfect example is the planet HD80606b. It's orbiting a star that's very similar to the Sun. And at the most distant point in its orbit, it's about as far away from its Sun as we are from ours and the Earth, except the Earth's orbit is almost circular. And then it dives in and it swoops just above the photosphere, above the surface of this star. And then it comes back out, and it takes like 112 days to go around once. But the way that the dynamics works is the closer you are to the star, the faster you're moving. So once it's crossed, the point where it would be as far away as Mercury from the Sun in our solar system, from that point to just getting to its closest near encounter with the star takes a week, and then it swoops out in a week. Now, imagine, it's changing its distance so dramatically, the flux that it's receiving, the amount of sunlight, starlight that it's receiving, is changing in a matter of hours. So the weather on this planet is changing in a matter of hours. I'm not talking about, like, the weather here might go from clear to cloudy to rain in a matter of hours here in Toronto. I'm talking about, globally, the entire planet's weather is changing in sync on that time scale. We talk about climate change, the average temperature of the Earth, it's on one level, going up by 1 or 2 degrees Celsius in a century. That's nothing. On HD 80606b, the temperature could go up by 400 degrees Celsius in 1 week and then go back down. It's a climate roller coaster. Again, science fiction writers never even imagined that there would be planets like this, that there would be environments like this. Now, by studying systems like HD 80606b and others, we are basically able to see how does an atmosphere respond to these changes under the most extreme conditions. And any climatologist worth her salt would give a glacier's worth of gold to have another environment, another climate on which to test climate change models. And that is what we are providing. We meaning not just the MOST team, but Corot, Kepler, and other exoplanetary scientists. And at the moment, we're getting the big picture stuff, and climatologists in Germany are already using those data to refine their climate models. But pretty soon, in the next few years, in the next few decades, we will be able to give you a much more detailed picture of some of these environments where you can do even more detailed tests. And what you're doing is taking your climate models and see how they work in more extreme corners of parameter space. And what that will mean is that they are, you know, more reliable in the relatively narrow range of parameter space that's so important to us here on Earth.
It's interesting to get the hot end. In our own solar system, we have perhaps a smaller example in some of these transneptunian objects, such as Pluto, mm-hmm. that see big changes in their orbits, but it's all very cold. It's all stuff that condenses out and then forms an atmosphere back mm-hmm. and forth.
Yeah. And that's all part of the picture. So we, you know, we certainly haven't abandoned our own solar system in the study of planetary sciences because, you know, the advantage of our solar system is things are relatively close. And we can actually send probes to places. We can take samples there. We can get close-up looks, which we are not able to do for exoplanets. And so it's all part of that, again, is together giving us this more comprehensive picture of how do planets form? How do they evolve, both dynamically in terms of the orbits? How did the planets in our solar system end up in the orbits they are today? And how are they going to change in the future? Because we can use MOST and these other instruments like time machines. We can't go back 4.5 billion years to see what it was like when the planets were being formed and when the sun was being born. We can't go forward billions of years to see what it would be like when the sun dies. But in our galactic city, in the Milky Way, population of several hundred billion stars, several hundred billion solar citizens, we can find the babies, the teenagers, the adults, the senior citizens, the cemeteries. And we're able to see examples of the sun's past and the solar system's past, the Earth's past in principle, and its future. And so that's something that we can't do in our own solar system, with the exception of things like the asteroids and the Kuiper Belt objects, things that are museum relics from the early history of our solar system. But none of them can take us into the future. But if we go out beyond the solar system, the time machine has both a reverse and a forward directions in the controls.
Speaking of the future, what upcoming projects in astrophysics and in terms of spacecraft, what really excites you that's coming up?
I'm very lucky in the sense of, you know, not only in terms of research, but in science education and outreach. Say I was teaching classical mechanics, which is very important. Fundamentally, there are not a lot of things have changed in classical mechanics. I hope there aren't any classical mechanics experts out there that are going to write in or tweet in and say, wait a second, what about this? But year after year, you could be teaching essentially the same thing. I can't do that. I mean, there are things that I was telling my students just last week that wasn't even on the table 5 years ago. We didn't even have the language for it. Things are changing. We're rewriting the textbooks, literally. And so in the two particular areas, the exoplanets and dark energy, the accelerating expansion of the universe, are two things that, like I said, less than 20 years ago were just not really on anybody's curriculum, and now are major topics. And those are two things that one can identify where they're, you know, we have no idea what is dark energy, and trying to figure out what that is going to be a major undertaking. Exoplanets is just this new frontier. Now, we have an explosion of new candidates. I mean, you go back to 1600s when Galileo first turned his telescope to Jupiter and saw that it was not just a wandering star, it was a world with things orbiting around it. And at that time, there were only 6 planets known to humanity. The 5 you could see without a telescope looking up, and the 1 you could see looking down the Earth. After like 418 years, in the era of telescopes, after Galileo had looked at Jupiter, we had added 3 planets to that list. To be honest, we'd really only added 2, because later we demoted Pluto.
Of course, we'd something similar with Ceres.
Yeah, that's right.
It's kind of got it.
Yeah. And so, like, we had increased the tally of known planets after more than 4 centuries in the era of telescopes by 30%. And then in the intervening 20 years, as of this morning, 763 confirmed planets and 2,300 candidates, of which I would estimate probably 80% will stand the test. And those numbers are rising. But I would argue that in the near future, and Kepler has completed its survey mission, and some of these other ground-based networks of telescopes are adding, we're going to have a sample of at least several thousands of planets, maybe tens of thousands. But then I would argue things are going to level off. The reason why people proposing the Kepler mission were able to get hundreds of millions of dollars for Kepler was, if you had to summarize the pitch, we will find Earths if they're out there. It's doing all sorts of other stuff, just incredible. But the thing that's going to sell it to politicians, to funding agencies, we're going to find exo-Earths if they're out there. And once you found them, then it's kind of hard to get another $1 billion to say we're going to find more Earths. The next pitch, I would say, is now that we know where are the Earths and where are the Earths in the habitable zones, we're going to find out, you know, do they have atmospheres? Do they have life? And so I think most of the exoplanetary systems that are being found by Kepler are relatively faint stars, 12th magnitude in astronomical parlance. That would be several hundred times fainter than the faintest stars you could see by eye. And it's difficult to do the detailed follow-up, even with big telescopes and instruments. You know, if you want to do the infrared spectroscopy, you want to do interferometry, you want to characterize those parent stars and the light that's coming from the planets around those stars and their thermal emission and so on. Challenging to do. We don't have the telescopes and the instrumentation that's possible to do that on those stars. We do have it for a number of the exoplanetary systems being explored by MOST around much brighter stars more nearby, but we don't have it for most of these. And so we are going to have to raise the stakes and develop a new generation of instrumentation to answer that question. Okay, now we know, where are the exo-Earths? Is there exobiology there? And I would say in this field, that's the next big step forward. And that's the kind of thing that excites everybody. You don't have to be a planetary scientist to be excited by that question of, is there life out there? I mean, many people believe that there's the alien life's already here. I think the X-Files and Fringe are documentary television series. But for most of us, to be able to provide scientific evidence of life that sprang up elsewhere, we know of life 1.0, to find life 2.0, I think that's the next big thing. And that's what's happening within the solar system as well. Mars exploration, and soon, hopefully, Europa and Enceladus exploration. Many planetary scientists and exobiologists, I think, if they were to place a bet on where most likely to find life today, independent of the Earth, Mars may now be taking a back seat to the possible water ocean under the icy crust of Europa or the geysers from the moon of Saturn and Enceladus. So yes, that search is certainly going on in our solar system. But the beauty of an exoplanetary system, absolutely no risk of any hitchhikers from, you know, like microbes from the Earth that went there and that we're just discovering our own. And on Mars, there's still the chance that, well, maybe, you know, any life on Mars actually hitched a ride on a meteoroid from the Earth there, or vice versa. In fact, all life here might have actually started by hitching a ride from Mars. But there might still be this question of, have we really found life 2.0, a really independent outcropping of life? With Europa and Enceladus, I don't think there is any ambiguity there if one found evidence for life in the liquid from those deep oceans or from those geysers. But if you're talking about Kepler-22b, which is a super-Earth in the habitable zone, if we eventually found evidence for life in that world, no one is going to question that it sprung up independently. And so I think that is one of the most important and exciting frontiers.
Without a doubt, it underpins sort of hiding in the shadows of a lot of the work we do in the solar system and in other solar systems. Thank you very much for speaking with us today.
You're very welcome.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So, we just listened to our host, Dr. John, interviewing Dr. Jamie Matthews about MOST, the Canadian Space Telescope.
Yeah, which has been a fantastically successful mission, right? As he said, this was supposed to be a year long. They were going to look at 10 stars. Now it's been up there for coming up on 9 years, and they've looked at thousands.
Yeah, I remember when it was actually first being developed, I actually knew one of the grad students who he mentioned, Station Rowe, who's now working on the Kepler mission. I remember them working on it and giving tours to people with their suitcase size.
It was a pretty big suitcase.
It was a big suitcase, but I mean, it's tiny compared to
the Hubble or the new James Webb Space Telescope.
Any spacecraft that has done astronomy on orbit before had to be bigger than that. For reasons that Dr. Math describes, it's hard to fit a mission into a tiny platform like this.
And one of the things that was also very small about it was the mirror itself, and only 15 centimeters.
Yeah, and the light-gathering power goes up with, what, the square of the...
Is it square?
Yeah.
So this is basically the area, and this is a very small area telescope.
And it's pretty...
But you can buy. I mean, I know plenty of amateurs with larger telescopes that they take in their trucks. Mm-hmm.
But are they getting the one in a million, you know, variation of the...
Well, of course not, because they have an atmosphere.
That's right. But even, you know, even if they didn't have an atmosphere, on the back of a pickup truck with a tripod, you can't make the telescope as stable as most is.
This is true.
Right? Then this is the innovation that Dynacon, now MSCI, was able to provide to the mission. The ability not just to fit the mission into this tiny little platform, 60-centimeter box, but to stabilize that platform enough to point at a single star reliably for a long duration.
Which is actually more difficult than you might think for a space telescope. On Earth, it's quite easy. We bolt the telescope down, and then we point it.
And even that is not easy. It's just less difficult.
But there's nothing to bolt to in space. You can't simply wheel your telescope around.
Yeah, and the slightest vibration doesn't get damped out. You're not connected to the planet that acts as a big reservoir for these vibrations. The thing rings like a bell every time anything moves on board.
And it never stops.
Mm-hmm. It takes a very long time to damp those things out. And you have to actively work to counteract them. The Hubble telescope, actually, this is one of the problems with the Hubble telescope when it was first launched. They would come out of eclipse. You know, it spends about 40% of its orbit behind the Earth in shadow. It comes out into sunlight, and the solar panels would stretch and change as they heated up, and they'd wobble and shake, and the telescope couldn't point at stars. Mm-hmm. They fixed that later. But even Hubble, with its much heavier mass, wasn't able to point well enough. And to do it with MOST, which, again, weighs something like 50 kilograms.
So about as much as me.
Yeah. Too bad our listeners cannot see Tyler.
Yeah, but okay, well...
As much as, you know, as a human being.
Sure, I mean, 54 kilograms is not very much.
Yeah.
And getting something like MOST to be that stable is very difficult.
And I think one of the really great things about MOST is that it's in this polar orbit so that it can, like you said, track on these stars for days or weeks or even months at a time, which we can't get with the Hubble, like you said, because it orbits around the Earth, and so it's going into sunlight most of the time.
And it's getting its view occluded by the Earth every once in a while.
Right.
And I mean, so Hubble has a very different viewing field, partly because of the orbit. But that sun-synchronous orbit does a couple of things. So you have this tiny little spacecraft, which means you can't have big batteries. So the sun-synchronous orbit along the terminator allows you to be continuously in sunlight. So you never have to store power, don't have to worry about having big, heavy batteries or big volume of batteries.
And you skip the thermal issues that Hubble had to deal with.
That's right. So the temperature on the spacecraft is relatively constant. So it simplifies the design and allows you to make things more easily fit into a little spaceship like that. But one of the other things that I found really compelling is that this is an example of technology development and science supporting each other. Dynacon has come up 10 years ago with this new technology of very fine pointing control. That's great, but what's the use if we have giant orbiting observatories? But then we have the scientists who propose to do something that requires very fine pointing. And it just happens that if they had not connected, who knows whether either the technology or the science would have succeeded. To me, it speaks to the importance of having engineering that's responsive to science and science that is aware of engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't always have those links.
It speaks to the utility of having science and engineering be very well connected, because it's easy for those to be separate worlds.
Yeah, and actually that's one thing that I think the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration does particularly well. If you have, at other universities around, you have the physics department, you have the engineering department, and not a lot of collaboration. But when you're doing planetary exploration, you kind of have to meld the both together.
Yeah, you don't get to have the kind of astronomy that Dr. Matthews and team have done unless you have a MOST. And the scientists can't build MOST, they need the engineers to do it.
Yeah.
But you don't get to do space missions unless you have a motivation, which is what comes from science most of the time.
That's right. So, I mean, we talk about, for example, the Mars rovers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not going to have, no offense to the scientists out there, but you're not going to be building that in your garage.
That's right.
Or in front of your computer.
Yeah, you know, I used to work in the European Space Agency where we were doing science experiments on the ISS. And the contractors, the industrial companies who were providing the hardware, were not full of scientists. They were full of engineers. They didn't know anything about the science. They just wanted to build things. And the scientists didn't know how to build things that work in space. And they weren't familiar with the implications or difficulties of doing it. And it was the job of the agency and our department to marry those things up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you start the project off with the scientists knowing something about technology and the engineers understanding a bit the science that needs to be done, you can marry those two things up a lot better in the end. And it's much less difficult. It's much less of an intensive work to make that happen. And this most seems to be an example of the two of them lining up very well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the other wonderful things about MOST is Well, one, how long it's lasted is allowed. Its mission has shifted serendipitously. It was originally designed just to look at variations in stars, astroseismology, tiny variations in brightness, which then turns out to be great for looking at exoplanets as well. But when MOST was being proposed, no one said, we're making a small telescope to look for exoplanets. That wasn't the plan. It just so happened that the science they wanted to do is compatible with this new fashionable field of exoplanet hunting.
Yeah, well, when you get good quality technology on orbit, you almost inevitably find that if it has more than one use, you will discover the other uses. Things like the stepping away from planetary for a minute, the robotic systems on the space shuttle and the space station. They're versatile, and they're precise, and they're reliable, and they're able to do things with them that were never foreseen. The Canadarm2 on the space station was not designed to support the docking of spacecraft, catch other spacecraft that were coming up there.
And yet next week it will.
It has done it before, and it will do it again. The one on the space shuttle was not designed to support inspection of the heat shield, but that's what it did every mission after Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
And so MOST is another example of this, and so are some of the other telescopes that we've seen on orbit. Hubble has done things that we never foresaw. You know, they didn't expect to use it to look at collisions of comets into Jupiter, but they did. So there's a lot to be said for investing in good technology development, especially if it's connected to the ability to make scientific discoveries.
Yeah, and another great thing about MOST is how inexpensive it was compared to, say, Hubble or the James Webb Telescope. If we could put these types of instruments up on a more regular basis, or only spend that much money, I don't know what the exact...
$10 million was the number quoted for the original budget of MOST.
As opposed to how many billion for the Hubble?
Over the course of its lifetime, many, right?
Also, MOST is very robust. I read about there's some hardware failure, and they still managed to keep it operational
by
updating the firmware and the software.
No one had to fly up the space shuttle to take care of MOST. Right. They just sent software.
Which costs a lot of money, right, if you have to go and do
$1 billion with a B.
And a toolbox.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's... The other thing, of course, is that if you build a system like that, it's easy to build another one. If MOST fails, we can make another one for another few millions, right? If James Webb fails the way Hubble did, there will be no fixing it because it's going to be out at its
It's going to be at L2, which is 1.5 million kilometers away.
Yeah.
Way out past the moon. I mean, great place for a telescope to be because you're not going to be having problems with the Earth. But yeah, it's going to be tough. I mean, it's going to take 30 days for it to even get out there to the orbit.
Exactly, which further increases the expense, right? Because if you're going to have a mission like James Webb, it's much more expensive to build something like that in the first place. But because it has to work, it has to be very, very reliable. You have to put a lot more effort into careful design and testing, and that all takes time and more expense. If MOST had failed after a year or even after a month, it would have been feasible, imaginable, to launch another one for a few millions. It's not imaginable to launch a second James Webb if it breaks.
Right. That being said, though, I think the James Webb Telescope is going to do a lot for astrophysical observation. I mean, it's going to be Hubble times 100 or 1,000.
Without question. And it speaks again to the value of having diversity of instrumentation. It's good to have a James Webb, and it's also good to have a MOST.
Yes.
Yeah, and everything in between.
Yeah.
Because it's small size, it was really cheap to launch. It only cost like $500,000, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, and I think it's a secondary launch, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was not the main payload. It was just bolted on the side.
So if your telescope is broken, you can just send another one.
Yeah.
Cheap.
And the launch costs are dropping, not precipitously, but slowly every year, the launch costs do go down a little bit.
Well, not monotonically, but...
No.
Yeah, I mean, it's... the idea of having these secondary payloads is... There's a whole market there for small spacecraft. There's been talk about developing dedicated launchers for small spacecraft like this, but that hasn't really gotten off the ground, so to speak.
And in fact, I would imagine it would end up being more expensive.
Well, so the difficulty with something like MOST is that, yes, it's in this sun-synchronous orbit. And part of the reason that it's there is because there's lots of spacecraft that use that orbit. You can hitch a ride on another rocket for some of the many Earth-observing spacecraft, for example, that go into sun-synchronous orbits. But if you want some other orbit, and there's lots of other legitimate reasons to want a different orbit than that, you may be stuck. You can't find another spacecraft that needs exactly the orbit
you want. Yeah, that's true. These buses that they put the multiple launches on do not have a lot of maneuvering capacity.
Well, and even if they did, if... if you're going to change the orbit at all, aside from raising its height slightly, you're going to need a whole lot of fuel. If you have to change the plane, it's game over, right? So being a small satellite, you're kind of stuck going into orbits that you can find a ride to, unless we get a, you know, some dedicated launcher. ESA has just run the first flight of their Vega launcher, but this is still made for like a 1.5-ton spacecraft to an orbit similar to that of MOST. And MOST is a lot smaller than that, so it still would be a secondary payload on a rocket, like even as small as Vega.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a niche thing. You're sort of using the spare capacity on these rockets and using small companies and small university labs to make small missions that can still do real science. The contribution of MOST has not been small, despite its budget and form factor.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that's the only thing about MOST that isn't small.
From an education outreach perspective, MOST is very cool because I saw on their website that you can actually submit proposals as a member of the public or a student or scientist, of course, to do observations. And you don't often get to see that on. It's not like you get to go to the Hubble Space Telescope and say, hey, I want to look at this star. So I think that's pretty
cool. Yeah, the time on those very expensive observatories that have hundreds of people working on them is very valuable. And so I think once with Hubble, they said for the 10th anniversary or something, they said, we'll let people choose which thing we're going to take a picture of. And once they did that, it took one picture.
Right. And it was probably out of a list of objects that they probably wanted to look at.
That wouldn't be surprising. Right? And so, so it's nice if you can use platforms like this to do that kind of outreach.
I mean, wouldn't that be a fantastic high school
science fair project?
I mean, so I, for my science fair project, I use the MOST Space Telescope. That would be amazing.
I think that would be good for even a master's project.
PhD.
Well, it depends on what you're doing with MOST. Yeah. Certainly, it has the capability to generate PhD quality data.
Yeah, I mean, they're discovering things all the time, right? So there's no reason why you couldn't use that for that purpose.
Yeah.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host John Moores. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Tyler August, Raymond Francis, Alyssa Gilbert, and Zengi Hu. Our editors were John Moores and Michael Forster. And, as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online, learn more about Western Worlds, and vote for your favorite episodes by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. The top choices will be played during the interregnum between seasons. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are Western-Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight and throughout our first season. We'll be back in a few months with a special on the landing of the Mars Science Laboratory rover Curiosity. I'm looking forward to it with bated breath. Until then, I hope that you can make world enough and time for Western Worlds again next season, right here on astronomy.fm.